This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this episode of Where Did the Road Go? As you know, for the last 2 weeks, we had Steph Young on the show. There's actually another part to that interview that's not really a part three, but a part that's going to be going up as a midweek podcast dealing with some of these weird drowning, well, non-drowning deaths of these college-age kids. Stuff that David Politis covered in his last book, but she's been studying it now for about 4 years. And so we have about a two-hour midweek podcast I'm going to be putting up soon on that subject. And if you're a Patreon, you'll get that probably tomorrow, I would think. I just got to finish editing it. And so anyone who was a fan of the last two shows, that's coming soon. And it's just over 2 hours long. All right. So next week, I also should point this out. Next week, we have back Aaron Gullius and Mike Cleland in the next part of our UFO history. Not exactly sure where we left off. I think it was in the late 90s. So we'll see if we can get up to the present. I'm guessing probably not, but we'll see. This is also the, I guess this is the third year anniversary of Where Did the Road Go? I started this back in 2013, and unless my math is completely wrong, this is our third anniversary. So, as my guest tonight, I have Mr. Seth. I don't want to say your name wrong. I assume it's how it's spelled, but...
Yeah, it's 100% how it's spelled, which is kind of awkward to say, but yeah, it's Breedlove.
All right. I was going to ask you that before we went on the air, and I totally forgot.
That's okay.
And you have produced, well, your movie company is what?
Small Town Monsters is the name of the movie company. I mean, it's called a production company. We're an LLC, but that's the official name of the production company. Small Town Media is also my... production company as well. It's a little complicated. They're basically the same thing. I just use both names.
Okay. All right. And you have two movies done and you're working on a third.
Yes.
Okay.
And we're busy.
And I love your logo, by the way. The logo's fantastic.
Yeah, that's I freaking love that logo. That was a guy named Michael Santee did that, and he lives up in Canada. And we actually met through like Twitter or something ages ago, but he did that for us about a year and a half ago. And people are always asking me if that's going to be on a T-shirt or something. Currently, it's only on a hat.
It should be on a T-shirt. It's a good logo.
Yeah.
Although it works well on a hat, too, I would think.
It does. It's cool. It's cool. It's a really and I think it captures my sense of humor. I don't know if it captures what the movies are like at all, but like the house is coming to life and stuff is right up my alley.
And the movies are more serious, really.
Very serious.
I've seen the first two. Your third one obviously isn't done yet. Mm-hmm. The first one is the Minerva Monster.
Yes.
And when did this come out?
That came out last May, actually, so less than a year ago when it was officially released on DVD. We had a crazy summer with it. We did it premiered at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference on May 16th, and from there we had our own festival out in Minerva on June 7th, I want to say, so a few weeks later. And then from there we just kind of showed it all over Ohio at different local screenings. And then we actually took it to New York, which was when we shot Whitehall the first time. And then we came back here and did more local screenings. And in between all of that, we were also doing library presentations. I think we probably did 20, 25 events last year during just from probably May until October, just showing the movie around and talking about it. So it was an extremely busy few months.
How was the response to it overall?
It was really positive, which is surprising in a way. Like I try to say this without sounding like I'm demeaning my own movie, but like, you know, it's a Bigfoot movie. It was our first movie. And it very much is like a straightforward retelling of those events, you know, very documentary like style. And there's no, you know, there's no narration. So it kind of had a lot going against it. But the response was always positive. I never really had anyone come up to me at an event and say they hated it. And honestly, even online, I haven't had a negative review, which is weird. But the movie, I mean, if you're in Ohio, it got a lot of press over the, you know, pretty much from the release on, and for a few reasons. Like, one is that I used to work for newspapers, so I know how to write a press release and gear it toward, you know, media. So that helped out, but also like I knew a couple people that worked in newspapers. So the way things go in Ohio is one newspaper picks it up and then they all start picking it up. And then we did around 70 interviews last summer, just around the movie. So the movie became almost like a local kind of meme in a way. Mm. Like I did a Twitter search today for it, just Minerva Monster, and some girl, like some, you know, teenage girl had posted like a selfie and said, "I'm the real Minerva Monster." And, you know, it's kind of like locally here, it's a big, for some reason, that became like a big thing. They were doing call-ins on the radio. You know, people were telling about their own Minerva Monster encounters and all this stuff. And it didn't have anything to do with us. So it'd be like I'd get into work one day and people would come up to me and say, "Hey, you know, Minerva Monster was on the radio again." And I'd be like, "I had no idea." So it was odd. It just kind of bloomed overnight here locally.
You want to tell people a little bit about this? And you said you're about 10 minutes away from where this all happened.
Well, I grew up about 15 to 20 minutes from Minerva, spent a lot of time there, still spend a lot of time there. But yeah, the story centers around one particular family, the Caton family, who live right outside of this tiny town in Ohio, which is where I am, northeast Ohio, called Minerva. And it's, you know, just kind of a blip on the Lincoln Highway. And their house sits off of the Lincoln Highway, and behind their house is a large hill and then a lot of other woods, kind of like woodland behind their house. And this one particular summer back in 1978, they started having uncomfortable kind of encounters with this upright walking hair-covered creature that they actually came to call it a pet, but... But we can, you know, we can talk a little bit about how the history actually started way before these events. But this one particular event in 1978 kind of kicked it off. And that event basically was that something killed the Caton family's dog. That was kind of what kicked off the whole thing and started making them feel like less comfortable with whatever this creature was. They basically had this large German Shepherd dog behind their house, and something came up out of the woods the one night and wrung the dog's neck. It was literally like, wow, pulled out of its collar and its neck was broke. So that kind of kicked off this event, these series of events that started really perplexing the Caton family and making them feel extremely uncomfortable. And they ended up having to call the police one night when this creature kind of approached them from the woods, and they were having kind of a family get together, and this thing came out of the woods and kind of startled them. They called the police. Police showed up and investigated the sighting, and because the police showed up, the local news media showed up, and when the local news media showed up, the story kind of broke nationwide, because one of the papers that covered it was the Akron Beacon Journal, which is it still is the third largest paper in Ohio. So wow. When that covered it, it got picked up by the AP, and the story ran coast to coast, which isn't in the movie. We didn't really get to document just how big of a story this was internationally, even, because it, you know, it ended up that like news media from Germany and Japan showed up at the Caton's house. And anyway, the whole thing kind of became a circus. The Caton's started finding themselves besieged by reporters, and, you know, Bigfoot hunters started showing up on their property and running off into the woods behind their house and firing guns and drinking six packs of beer and all kinds of craziness. And And basically, they became the center of ridicule in the town as well. So that's the film kind of documents that 1978 stuff most in depth. But there were sightings before it, and there were sightings after it, and there are still sightings. The Cadens still see the Minerva monster today, like behind their house. I mean, I've talked to Howie in the last probably 5 months, and he was still seeing things behind the house. So, and there's a lot of odd and unusual activity connected with the story too that we didn't get the document, which happens with every one of these, you know, types of projects. That's sure. That's one of the downsides of doing movies over like literature, is that, you know, we have a finite amount of time to really cover it. And in the case of the Minerva story, there was so much going on, and none of it had ever really been documented, you know, like Bigfoot or UFO sightings and ghosts behind the house and disappearing caves. And it's an odd story, and I honestly don't know what to make of it.
So it's kind of a vortex area with lots of weird things going on.
Here's the thing though. It is, if you talk to the Catons, it is, but their neighbors on both sides of them, I also spoke to, and they both claimed that they didn't know anything about that activity. Now, they did both claim they knew about the monster, and they believed there was something back in the woods, but neither of them knew about the other stuff. So it's kind of odd. It's an odd case, and but it's fascinating to me because I get into the psychology of what's going on, you know, and
kind of
how it impacts the family and that kind of thing. You know, the family was really... I mean, the first story that kind of ran in the Akron Beacon Journal on this particular story called the Minerva monster their pet. And that was because the family almost came to think of it in that way. They fed it. They left scraps in the pit, the gravel pit behind their house. And not gravel pit. It was a, what was it? Like a, oh, it's just a big pit behind their house. They used to dump scraps down in it. And this thing would supposedly come down off this hill and feed off of it.
Huh. And I mean, it seems like when I was watching the movie, mm-hmm. it seems like there is some physical, there was like bedding found.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the really cool things about the story is that there is this, you know, you talk to people in the area other than them who live right there, because there's a bunch of houses kind of on all sides, not all sides of them, but that kind of dot this road. And you can talk to people that live there, and they've all got stories about, you know, we heard something in the woods, we heard this, we saw that. But yeah, the Catons found this unusual, what looked like something had bedded down. I believe the line that the sheriff used when he described it said it looked like Howie. Howie laid down on it and said he looked like a baby on a king-sized bed. And wow. I don't know. I always loved that line. And Brandon Dalo, that does the music and produces the movies, he actually used that line for the title of that song that plays over that sequence. But Baby on a King-Size Bed, I always thought was really cool. But yeah, they have a photo of that bedding. They have a photo of that kind of like what looks like a tunnel dug through the thorns and the briars. I don't know what you would call it. It's not a tunnel, but you know, like it looks like you can clearly see it's a pathway that something was moving up and down this hill through all this underbrush. And then there was, you know, there was talk of footprints that were found, and there's talk of like scat that was found. But there's, you know, as far as that stuff goes, we have no evidence of it. We do know right. that we do know that the sheriff found this unusual bone, what he called a jawbone, and took it to Malone University to have it identified. And Malone University, there's two different versions of the story. The sheriff tells that they took it to Malone University. Malone identified it as a jawbone of a cow and then lost it. Now, everyone else that you talk to says they never identified it. They never were able to identify it as the jawbone of anything. They just lost it. So I'm nice. Curious. I'd love to know what, you know, what it was, but that's something people always ask about because it's mentioned in the film, but
yeah.
you know, it's still missing. They lost this jawbone of whatever it was, and it never did turn up.
And there was a smell associated with this creature too, right?
Ammonia. Yeah. And I have kind of a cool story about that because the sheriff always said whenever he went out to the property, he would smell ammonia. And he, you know, he wasn't out there just one time. He I wouldn't say he became obsessed with the story, but he definitely was investigating it even in his free time, like going out to their house and spending time in the woods during that week. And he said he always smelled this ammonia smell. And when we were there filming, on the very first time we went there to film, we went way up in the woods behind their house. And the way like I said at the beginning, the way their land sits, there's this huge hill that used to be, I keep wanting to say gravel pit, but it's not that. It's one of those big, you know, it's that whole area has been mined at one time or another.
Wow,
so
okay.
It's one of those huge hills. And behind that, there's just more of that. So there's a lot of woods and there's roads and houses here and there, but we always say, we took a plane and flew over it. We always say whenever, you could actually stay in the tree line and walk all the way to Pennsylvania from where they live. So,
wow.
So, we were down there. Where was I going with that? I know.
The smell.
I was up. Yeah. I'm up in this woods behind their house. And sure enough, we smelled what smelled very strongly of ammonia, right up probably 400 yards from the back of their house. So that was kind of a cool thing, because I felt like, you know, it's probably nothing, honestly, but it could even be like a phantom smell. But I thought it was cool to get to live a little bit of that story for a minute.
are they the only ones that ever reported the smell?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. And it's not something I typically hear of in connection with Bigfoot cases either. You don't hear of like an ammonia smell.
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting. Now, someone got bitten by this thing too, right? Or claimed to?
Yeah, he claimed to, but it's a funny story. It's between that and the story about the rock getting thrown at the lady and hitting her right between the eyes. I thought those two stories were the most kind of outlandish in the movie, but both of them have kind of been corroborated by other people. So basically, Howie tells this story that Howie's the oldest Caton boy. He tells the story that him and his brothers and then one of their friends were walking around a quarry pond near their house. And this quarry pond's kind of the center of a lot of activity, not just with them, but with other people. There's another guy in the movie who talks about having a sighting there when he was a teenager. And so there's a lot of activity centered around that pond. But Howie tells the story that they were walking along the outside of this pond and they looked kind of down this embankment, and right down on the edge of the pond, kind of hunched over, was this creature, this hair covered, you know, upright walking creature. So boys being boys, I guess, they decided naturally that they were going to jump on the creature. So supposedly these four boys jump the creature. They literally leap over the embankment. They land on it. The thing kind of grabs one of the boys and bites him on the back. And that's the story. I mean, basically it threw him to the ground and this thing took off into the woods and they ran home. And, you know, supposedly if you read the police report references the fact that the family actually called the police. I can't find evidence of a police report for that particular case. I can't find evidence that they actually did call the police about that. But it's a really fascinating story because of the fact that the guy actually, Howie's brother, actually backs that story up. He says, no, I did get bit. I haven't asked him to show me the scars yet, but that's going to happen probably this summer if I run into him. Because I want to see, you know, like supposedly he still has these Bigfoot bite scars. So I do think that, you know, of all the things you could possibly say to someone to make them kind of tune you out, saying that you jumped a Bigfoot and they got bit, it has to be like right near the top. But,
yes.
But that's what they claim. And, you know, the fact that he has other guys that corroborate the story is really, really unusual.
Yeah. I mean, I would be more convinced if he had at least photographs.
Yeah. I would love if we had photographs of almost anything connected with the case, other than the ones that the Akron Beacon took at the time of the bedding and the, you know, the little tunnel through the undergrowth. But there's nothing. Now the Catons do have, they do claim to have photos of the creature, and Brandon Dalo actually said he got to spend more time with them this past summer than I did, and they showed him the photos, and he does say. That in one of the photos there does appear to be some sort of odd creature, and his description of it actually gave me kind of goosebumps because it's so in line with what they say as a description for the Minerva monster. You know, it's an unusual Bigfoot description. It's got this kind of mop top hair. But the photo that Brandon was telling me about, it actually, he says what's really unusual about it is it almost looks like the top of its head has kind of like golden hair or blondish hair. But he said it's a very believable photo. He doesn't know what's in it, but he said, of all the blob squatch photos there are, it's actually one of the better ones he's seen.
And he didn't get a copy of it though, huh?
No, of course. No, no. The Catons are very guarded. You know, they've got these photos. They had never spoken to anyone about this on film. This was the first time anyone managed to get Howie Caton on film talking about this case. In fact, Howie had been asked to come on like an episode of Finding Bigfoot and had turned them down right before he did Minerva Monster. So we lucked out.
Yeah, yeah. One of the other things that was interesting was the throwing rocks.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really thought was very interesting is they said they were warm when they were thrown back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you get also with poltergeist accounts, that when rocks get thrown and stuff, they're warm. And people, of course, associate with like apportation and stuff like that. I mean, sure, they could be warming them up by holding them, but I'm wondering if there wasn't Bigfoot sightings, would this be called a poltergeist account, you know?
It's interesting because I was telling you before we started that there's a lot of unusual activity that takes place there beyond just the Bigfoot sightings, and there is poltergeist is involved. I mean, they also claim to have seen like Native American people in full, you know, Native American headdress and all that on the hills behind the house. There's a lady on a horse that they've seen. There's supposed to be a lot of unusual activity that takes place there.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Where did all this start? Where are the earliest encounters you were able to find?
Well, I mean, see, here's the thing. What got me into Bigfoot was the kind of historical sightings, the really old early 19th century, 20th century kind of, you know, the ancient stuff, not literally ancient, but the really old stuff.
Right, right.
And in Ohio, there's a lot of that. And it goes all the way back to the oldest report in Ohio that's in a newspaper is from 1869. And it took place in a town called Gallipolis, Ohio, which actually isn't that far from Minerva. I mean, maybe an hour. But, you know, in Minerva is probably only, as the crow flies, maybe 20, 25 miles from Salt Fork State Park, which is kind of considered the mecca of Bigfoot activity in Ohio. So they're not far from there. The area where they are has definite sightings that go back to the 1800s, late 1800s. But this, as far as their area, you know, the Minerva monster sightings, the oldest we have in the film is from a guy that thinks his father might have had an encounter while he was in an outhouse back in 1957.
Right.
And that took place directly across the street from where they live. So the sightings in Ohio go way back, and the sightings kind of in that Minerva area obviously go way back. And I think there's enough historically that takes place in that area to make it worth looking into. You know, this when you're talking these sighting reports that go back to the late 1800s, because we have them from New Philadelphia, Ohio, and, you know, even the town I grew up in, Bolivar, had legends when I was a kid that go back to the 40s.
Wow. The there was one description of them there, one of the stories, they were calling it a hairy witch, and they were also saying there were two little ones around it.
Yeah. Yeah, the little ones is a cause for contention amongst some, because the Catons claim the little ones are panthers. Howie says they're, I think he actually said they were black cats, but Brandon says he was probably referring to them more as like tabby cats or, you know, tawny, what would you call it? Mountain lions, I guess, basically. But supposedly that's what the Catons were seeing, is these cats. And Brandon said one of the creepier things about it is that they actually do have a photo of what looks like a full-grown mountain lion behind their house. Not a bobcat, but an actual mountain lion.
Huh.
So, and in this part of Ohio, obviously, the, you know, the ODNR claims we don't have those. They don't exist
right,
here.
Right, right.
Which is bullcrap because I've seen them. I've seen one in Cuyahoga Valley National Park, which is actually further north from here. So it makes even less sense up there. But I know for a fact they're here. But so that's what the Caton see. Now, this guy says that what he saw were two little ones. And, you know, he referred to them as kind of hunched over, walking with their hands were maybe dragging slightly above the ground. They weren't quadrupeds, but they were bipedal, but kind of hunched forward. And he thought they looked like juveniles. In fact, one of the funnier things is he kept referring to them as like great balls. And what he meant by that was balls of fur. Like that's basically what they looked like to him, was these balls of fur, which is really different from what the Catons are describing. Now, I've asked Howie Caton, you know, are you sure you weren't seeing what this guy's seeing, which is these kind of, you know, hunched forward smaller ones? Could they have been juveniles? And he's adamant that what he saw was cats. So, and I've talked to, I've done a lot of work down in Minerva. I do a lot of videography stuff, and I shot a video project for a lady who owns an alpaca farm down there. And she told me that they've seen mountain lions in the woods behind their house, and they live probably a quarter mile from the Caton. So there obviously is, you know, this kind of feline activity down there. What he saw, I'm not sure. I love his description of the hairy witch, because I've never heard anyone describe that kind of creature as a hairy witch. But I think it's really cool that as a kid, you know, he was connecting it with what he knew, which was witches. Witches scared him, and that's what he connected this unknown creature he saw in the woods with.
And I do like with this documentary, that you're not coming out and being like, here's proof of Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. You're just presenting, here are the cases, here's what people say happened, and you're just leaving it at that, letting people kind of make up their own mind on the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's that. It would probably fits more with my own personal take on the subject. I think we tried to do the same thing again with Whitehall. It's mm-hmm. it's what I try to bring to the table as someone who's a little on the skeptical side myself. Is, you know, I'm not going to try to steer people one way or another, especially if they're not already a believer. It is, you know, when you hear these people tell their stories, it does make you wonder what is it that actually happened.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to get across to the more skeptical people like myself, is listen, you it's not a simple thing to just discontinue or discount this entire subject in general. Like, listen to what these people have to say and try to make up your own mind about it.
Yeah, and there's so many cases, as we were talking before, I mean, there's so many cases going back throughout history of mm-hmm. wild men in the woods and stuff, that there's got to be something behind it. The question becomes, what is it? And if it's a physical phenomena, the big question that every, you know, that always comes up is, why aren't there bodies?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even one body, that one, you know, there's that one Bigfoot that tripped and fell or got hit by a car and the person picked up the body, you know?
Well, yeah, and I always say we've been here for centuries. I mean, we've been in the Americas for centuries. You'd think, you know, if they're here. But, I mean, I can give you the standard, you know, kind of defense mechanism responses to that, which is, you know, that we don't really see a lot of black bears in the wild.
Right.
You know, the soil in Ohio alone is very, you know, acidic, so it eats skeletons quickly. You know, they ran this test where they kind of staked a deer out in the woods, and the deer was completely disintegrating, gone within 2 weeks. So we've got that kind of defense for this stuff. My favorite has always been this account from Africa in the 1970s, where a man saw an explorer or something, saw these mountain gorillas actually bury one of their dead under palm fronds, which I thought was kind of a cool, you know, it makes you think, well, maybe it's because of this. But no, I totally agree with you. It's if it's such a flesh and blood kind of, you know, creature, why don't we have those things? And what does that mean? Does that mean it's a paranormal creature, or does it mean it doesn't exist and this is all psychological? Or is it, you know, maybe these things do bury their dead? Yeah. It's just every potential question breeds about 1,000 more questions. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's... We don't really know anything about them. Perhaps they're much smarter than us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we don't have any evidence of them.
Sure.
I mean, just because they're big, hairy things that live in the woods doesn't mean they're stupid, doesn't mean they're less intelligent than we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you know, you have accounts like the one that Brian Gosling gives in the Whitehall movie about how the creature's appearance was much more manlike than ape, which is why he couldn't shoot it.
Yeah,
which I always find fascinating, this idea that, you know, that they're not an ape. I mean, personally, my own personal belief is that if these things are real, then, you know, I think personally that the evidence that we do have points toward an ape over something else, but. I do. I try to explore everything.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, first, where can people find the Minerva Monster?
Shop.smalltownmonsters.com is our kind of storefront, and that's where all our projects will be available. It's also on vimeo.com/ondemand/Minerva Monster for streaming.
Okay. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Seth Breedlove.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and not necessarily those of WVBR or its management. Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to WhereDidTheRoadGo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at WhereDidTheRoadGo.com.
And sometime soon I'm going to have a new intro and a new middle piece there with Intrepid Radio mentioned as well. Yeah, all right. So we're talking with Seth Breedlove right now. We've been talking about his first movie, The Minerva Monster. This is the first movie you've made, right?
Minerva Monster, yes.
Okay. And the one that's going to be coming out soon is...
Beast of Whitehall is the second film we made. And like we were talking beforehand, this is a shorter project. And this originally began life as a 15-minute short. That was what we saw it as being. And the original idea for Small Town Monsters was going to be, you know, because these are independent films. I mean, we entirely fund them out of pocket. Or in the case of the next one, we're actually going to try to kickstart it starting in about 25 minutes. but the idea was to do these longer movies like Minerva, and then in between each longer movie, we would do a short. And that way we could put out about 2 movies a year. But what happened with Beast of Whitehall is we went and we shot the whole movie in New York. And at some point, you know, during the shooting of it, I started thinking there's a lot more story here than just a 15-minute short, even with the obstacles we faced, which are the fact that essentially Whitehall is 3 main interviews. That's it. There's Paul Bartholomew, there's Brian Gosling, there's Bill Brand, and then there's a few other characters that kind of pop in here and there. I think there's probably 3 or 4 other people that appear in the movie. But what kind of blew it up for us was the fact that Bill Brand had these audio tapes, interviews with the people that were actually there at the first sighting that happened with the Beast of Whitehall. So because of that, we decided this was going to be a much, you know, longer form movie than I had originally intended. So it comes out to around 40 minutes instead of the original 15 that we had planned on doing. But you just have to go where the story takes you, and there was a lot more than 15 minutes to tell here.
You want to tell people like the basic encounter?
Yeah,
because this is really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating story. I think it gets overlooked a lot too. But basically, the Whitehall case is called, typically referred to as, the Abear incident, and that's because it took place on a road called Abear Road, right outside the town of Whitehall. These 2 boys were driving on a dark road late one night, and they see this upright walking, hair covered creature, much like the Minerva one, in a field off of Abear Road. And they turn around, they come back, they point a gun at it, the thing screams at them, they take off, they go back to Whitehall, and they get another friend of theirs. So these 3 boys come back out to Whitehall, and the creature is still there. So they have another brush with it. So after this happens, they turn around, they go back to Whitehall, and they get one of the boys' fathers. And this guy was actually one of the boys, Paul Gosselin. His dad was the chief of police in Whitehall. His name was Wilfred Gosselin. And Paul's older brother, Brian, was also a law officer at the time. So they get his father calls in some other guys, and basically eight members of law enforcement, and these three boys head out to Whitehall, or head out to Hebert Road. And when they get out there, this creature's still out there. So we're now at 11 people seeing this creature in a field, and eight of them are law enforcement officers. So they all have this sighting, and it kind of kicks off this week-long event. It really overlaps with Minerva in some ways, because the same thing happened with Minerva, where you have this one kind of inciting incident, and it kicks off, you know, a week-long series of events. I think in Minerva it ran more like 2 weeks, where a lot of people were seeing it. But in this case, it was about a week, and you had all sorts of things happen. The next night after this initial encounter, the next night, Brian Gosselin, Paul's brother, goes out to the field late at night and has his own encounter while he's with a highway patrol officer. So these two guys have an encounter. A night or two after that, a man that owns a house on a road perpendicular to Hebert Road claims that he fired shots at an upright walking creature. And while all this is taking place, there's a massive UFO flap taking place in Whitehall too, which we didn't get to go into in the movie.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and when I say massive, I'm talking like there was literally a report from a lady that lived right in downtown Whitehall who claimed that this circular craft landed in her front yard right in downtown. And when they actually came out to investigate it, when Wilfred came out to investigate it, he found a circular burn mark in the middle of the yard. It's a really unusual case for multiple reasons, not just the fact that you've got all these law enforcement officers, but you've also got, you know, the UFO angle and the ridicule angle. The ridicule angle to this story is pretty high. There's a lot of people that, you know, don't embrace the subject of Bigfoot. And in fact, the version of the movie that you saw, I had to rewrite some of the narration that you saw in the cut you saw to reflect that a little better. When there's a small section of the movie that kind of details what Adirondack culture is like and how the people, I think in the version you saw, I talk about it, it's talked about more as if people love their stories of Bigfoot in that region. And I think originally that was my impression of it, and since then I've come to find out that people hate Bigfoot up in that section of the country. Not everyone, but it's really kind of a mocked, you know, subject up there, and people don't want to talk about their encounters, and they really don't embrace it. So I had to rewrite the narration actually to reflect that better. But that's a big angle to this particular story. And, you know, Brian is convinced that there was a cover up within the, you know, the local community and possibly the government to cover up the story in Whitehall. I don't know if he thinks, you know, I've asked him if he thinks it was simply because he thought that they looked bad or if he thought it was to cover up an existence. I think in his opinion, it's more of a, you know, he thinks they were trying to just cover it up because they were afraid that, you know, the town of Whitehall was going to look crazy.
Right, right. And unless you're going to capitalize on the craziness like Roswell does, it's not going to do anything good for your town.
Right. It can, though. See, that's the thing. Like, this is what frustrates me about the tiny towns that don't embrace their monsters is, like, it can be a real boon to, like, local tourism, and they're just starting to figure that out in Whitehall. But it's still, like, you know, in that area, for the most part, people still kind of laugh at it.
You've made this even more interesting to me now that you mentioned there was a UFO flap going on at the same time. When you were talking about this a few minutes ago, I was thinking, you know, these things happen in flaps just like UFOs do. And of course you have this thing had red eyes, which Keel, you know, John Keel nicknamed these things red-eyed monsters because you get all shapes and sizes, and the one common factor is red eyes, and so many of them happen during UFO flaps. So again, you're looking, I mean, does this thing have a history, or is it just pop up once in a while?
Well, as far as the red eyes go, Paul told me an interesting story about how one of the local historians there, this guy, I can't remember his name, but he was actually a teacher, a history professor, and he had told Paul, and I think Bill Brann as well, he told them that he had uncovered Indian legends, Native American legends, about creatures whose eyes glowed like coals or timber. I can't remember, like tinder. I can't remember which what the phrase was, but it was something like that. Their eyes glowed like coals. And so there's a history there going way back of these kind of glowing red-eyed creatures, which I, you know, I've heard all the kind of Indian legends that people refer to as being Bigfoot, but I'd never heard that. I'd never heard them directly refer to that physical trait. So I thought that was really curious. So there's definitely that kind of history there, you know, as far as that abnormality, that red-eyed creature. And like you said, every single person in the movie at some point talks about either seeing the red eyes or, you know, talking to someone who saw the red eyes. So this isn't a case where, you know, we had the red eyes with the Minerva case too, though. Although in that, yeah, in that case, it was an orange. They said they glowed orange.
I missed that. All right.
Yeah, it's. I don't know that it's in the movie.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I found that out after the filming of the movie. I was down there, and if you watch the DVD, there's a behind the scenes on there, and there's actually shots of me up on the hill behind their house late at night with night vision. And we were up there, and their daughter was out with me, and she was telling me that she sees the orange eyes on the hill behind their house all the time.
Huh. That's interesting. Well, what was it like doing these? I mean, was it difficult to get some of these people to talk?
Yeah, it's extremely. In the case of Minerva, like I said, Howie had never gone on camera. His sister refused to come on camera. The whole family really didn't want to come on camera. In the case of Whitehall, it's even more difficult because in that one we're actually trying to race the clock. We lost our primary witness the day we decided we were going to make Beast of Whitehall. We decided on May 16th, which was the day that Minerva Monster premiered, we decided we were going to make that our next movie, and that same day Paul Gosselin passed away.
So we're
racing the clock there too, because these guys are, you know, Paul was actually fairly young, but some of these other people that are in these movies are getting up there in years, you know.
Right.
And in the case of like Boggy Creek Monster, which we're making next, which kind of focuses on those Legend of Boggy Creek sightings, the Falk Monster, took place all the way back in the 60s and early 70s, like 71. And a lot of those people have passed away. So you're dealing with that to start with. And then once you can track the people down, you know, it took me a lot of coercing with Brian to get him to agree to come on camera. He just, you know, and he talks about it a lot in some of the footage I shot behind the scenes, how he just believes that, you know, the people that have covered the Whitehall story have made him out to be, they've either just horribly told the story untruthfully, and they've got him in like a, you know, a police uniform, and he's out there running through the field with a gun and like all this stuff, instead of how it actually happened. That stuff really takes him aback. He can't stand it. So
that's understandable.
Yeah, it is. And that's kind of what I was dealing with the Catons as well, is that Howie just figured we were going to kind of make them out to be, you know, either fools, or we were going to blow it up and make it some sort of, you know, Bigfoot with another horde of Bigfoots trying to besiege their home or something like that.
Right, right. Well, you're not sensationalizing these encounters. You're not doing reality TV.
No.
I mean, you seem to be kind of presenting a very dry, honest view of it. And like I said, you're not forcing any particular viewpoint.
Right. Yeah, and I think in the case of, well, both films, but I really think there is a creepy atmosphere. Just telling the story the way it happens, and then letting Brandon kind of work with his music, and you know, there's something inherently creepy about a man alone in a field late at night hearing something huge and unknown walking toward him. You know, I mean, that alone is kind of creepy. So the, you know, like it's like you said, we want to just tell the stories the way they should be told, because I think the drama and the kind of creep factor and the creepiness of it is already there, built into the actual reality of the story.
Yeah, it's not you guys running around the woods with night vision goggles for, you know, an hour.
Thank God. Yeah.
So that is going to be out when?
April 1st is the official release date for that, and it's not an April Fool's joke, which seems to be people's favorite question right now to ask me. But it's April 1st is the official date when you'll be able to order the DVD off the website. It will actually be available as a Kickstarter reward to Boggy Creek Monster. So if you back the Boggy Creek Monster Kickstarter campaign that goes live tonight, you'll actually be able to see the movie on March 3rd. So, and nice. you'll own a digital copy of it. So we're going to give like basically a special sneak preview to people that back the campaign.
Nice. And let's talk a little bit about the Boggy Creek one. Now this is going, the Kickstarter starts in what, 15 minutes or so?
Yeah, 14 actually. Not that I'm counting, but.
And what are you raising money to do exactly?
On this one, we are funding the entire movie through the Kickstarter campaign, which we've never done before. But because of the story itself having the notoriety it does, you know, everyone kind of knows that Legend of Boggy Creek movie.
Sure. And Lyle Blackburn has done a lot to help bring that out even further.
Yeah, definitely. And so what we want to do is really go all in on this one. That's kind of what we keep saying is let's up everything. Let's up all the production values. I think you can see a jump in quality from Minerva to Whitehall.
Yeah.
You know, in audio and video and all that, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. And to do that, you do have to raise, you know, the money to actually get the cameras you need and the sound equipment you need and stuff. So on this one, we want to get all that stuff, like cinematic cameras, cinematic you know, audio equipment and all that stuff. And plus, taking a crew down to Arkansas is a little difficult. Whitehall was a smaller scale film. It was shot, you know, entirely by Brandon and myself. And then my dad went with us one of the times we went to help with lighting. So that was a small scale film. This one's going to be a lot bigger. We're hoping to make this one as a feature length movie as well.
Mm.
So it's just a bigger kind of project, and that demands an actual budget to work for or to work with. So, yeah, so the Kickstarter campaign is going to actually go toward funding everything. So actually getting all the equipment, getting, you know, probably four or five guys down to Arkansas for about 8 days of shooting is what we're planning on. So a 10-day trip because it's 16 hours from here in Ohio to down there. We actually drove it back in October. My dad and I drove down there and did the trip in one day, and it is hellish to drive that far.
Yeah.
Well, but
you wouldn't actually be able to drive back there and back in one day. So
right. So yeah. So it's kind of a full-fledged production Kickstarter, and we're still, I mean, I think the total goal is $9,000, which if you know about, you know, like filmmaking, that's a minuscule budget.
Yeah, absolutely.
For this kind of thing. But I mean, also, like, we've learned how to handle, you know, a budget and how to make things on next to nothing. Mm-hmm. It's just, we really want to get this, the production values and all that up on this movie. And it really demands it. I mean, it's a fascinating location. You know, the Sulphur River bottoms and that, those kind of swampy landscapes and stuff, you got to get that right when you're showing it, because it's such a creepy atmosphere. I got to go there back in October, and when we went, it was a torrential downpour, and I actually got to shoot some B-roll around the Sulphur River bottoms during this torrential downpour / thunderstorm that happened. And it ended up being the teaser trailer for the Kickstarter that I cut together. So it demands it, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. What kind of rewards are you giving people?
We have a Boggy Creek Monster t-shirt that's like a one color black and white t-shirt. It matches up with the Minerva Monster one we did. There's kind of this retro look to these that we try to kind of copy that 1970s kind of feel with them. That's really cool. We have a poster designed by Sam Sheeran of the creature itself. That's really cool. We have a hoodie that's based on that design. We have probably my favorite thing is these pens. My dad does these custom pens. I talk a lot about my dad on these shows, by the way. but my dad does these custom pens. And in this case, he actually got wood. He found wood from the... boy, that sentence just was... he actually... He found some wood on the property, the Ford property, which if you've seen the movie, the Ford property is the house where the thing actually came through the window while the kid was on the toilet and all that stuff. I don't know if you remember the movie, but that's the Ford house. And my dad found this huge piece of wood and took it and actually turned it into pens. So
nice.
And he's, so those pens are actually made out of that wood. And then he's got this really cool custom box, like a wood box, and it's got the Boggy Creek Monster logo engraved on it. And then Lyle and I signed it, and those are engraved on the inside. So that's kind of a cool thing. You get your name in the credits of the movie if you back it. And then there's a ton of like digital rewards. So you get behind the scenes production diaries. We're going to keep people updated every single day while we're actually filming the movie down there.
Cool.
So you'll actually be able to watch video of us working at the end of every day. So we'll do that. And then there's the Beast of Whitehall early, you know, sneak preview version. Mm-hmm, and then obviously pre-orders of Boggy Creek Monster on DVD and a digital copy of that.
Now, you also said something about you were going to be coming up this way with to show the Beast of Whitehall in the area.
So like we're hoping to be able to come up there the first weekend in April. It's not set in stone. I'm still trying to work with the Chamber of Commerce in Whitehall on it. If not, if we can't pull that off, it's definitely already agreed upon that it will be on TV there. Already signed an agreement with a TV station up in your area. Well, not your area.
It's northeast of here.
Right. So there's a little network up there. And I think they do PBS and all that kind of stuff too. So there's actually three different channels that are going to air it, but it's going to run for probably five times between mid-April and late May. I agreed upon that. So it's going to be available up there. And I just don't have the official information as to whether or not we're going to be able to do a premiere. But if we do, it will be a full-scale event. We'll have two showings of the movie. We'll have Paul Bartholomew speak. We'll have Bill Brand speak. We'll have Brian speak.
Nice.
And we'll show the movie.
What? Now you do a podcast of your own.
Yeah.
And what's that?
Sasswhat, a podcast about Bigfoot.
It's, all right.
I do it with my buddy Mark Matsky, and we talk every week about just different things in the world of Bigfoot that fascinate us. We both come at it a little more skeptically. Not that we're mocking or anything, but neither of us are 100% stone cold believers. So we kind of approach things just as ourselves. And it's just a loose show. The one that's going up tomorrow will have Lyle Blackburn on it. So if you're in the mood, you can check out us talking. Basically, we just ramble about Legend of Boggy Creek the whole time.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
and where can people find that? What's your main website?
For Small Town Monsters is smalltownmonsters.com. There's a sasswhat.com, but I haven't updated it in like 2 years. So to get the podcast, it's sasswhat.podbean.com. But we're on iTunes and Stitcher and all that stuff too.
Right. Okay, cool. And what are you aiming for with the Boggy Creek release?
My dream is to have it out by Halloween.
Oh, that'd be good. That's good, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it'll happen because that gives us basically 4 months to edit it, but that's my dream.
What other things do you think you're aiming for in the future? Do you have any plans, anything you'd like to do?
Yeah, we do a festival out in Minerva every year, Minerva Monster Day, and this year we're going to do a short film festival, so anyone in the Ohio area, well, I guess anyone anywhere can submit an all-ages friendly short film, 5 minutes and under, and we're going to kind of play them all together at the theater. You get to see it on the big screen, then the winner is going to get prizes, and we'll have second place and third place and all that stuff. And then on Saturday, this is taking place September 23rd and 24th, and then on Saturday we're going to play our movies, so Beast of Whitehall and Minerva for sure. And we're also going to have a speaker who I'm not sure yet who it's going to be. We're going to probably have a few people speaking, and there's vendors, and but it's kind of like, essentially it boils down to a small town monsters festival, but it's called Minerva Monster Day.
Cool. What about future movies? What do you have? Do you have any? And I know you probably not have anything planned out yet, but what would you like to do?
I am so glad. I'm serious. I'm glad you asked me, because like I had this conversation with Lyle yesterday about how fascinating Smokey Crabtree's life was. He was the one that was connected to the Boggy Creek story. And he had this I had this thought when I was listening to, he just passed away this past week. And as I was listening to these stories about him, I just thought of Ahab and Moby Dick. And it just, Smokey reminds me of Ahab, and the Bigfoot is the white whale.
Huh.
And I just was like, man, that would make an amazing movie. So that's a dream of mine. But my real dream right now is to do this movie called 1999 that kind of is about my upbringing in small town Ohio. And it, you know, just honestly, it's probably going to be more like Dazed and Confused or American Graffiti, but it's about as far from like small town monsters as you could get. But I do want to, we have a lot more small town monsters projects we want to do.
And is it always going to be Sasquatch?
No.
Okay.
No, I want to get away from Sasquatch, especially next. Whatever we do next, if it's small town monsters, I promise you it's not going to be Sasquatch. It's aliens or lake monsters or something. I got to get out of Bigfoot for a little while.
I think aliens are a hard fit with cryptids.
It is. It's difficult. But if, you know, with us, it's more about how these creatures or these sightings impact the town become part of that local legend. And I think there are cases like that.
I think when you have like the, I think it's the Hopkins, I can't say the word. The goblins.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about. When they were shooting them and they kept coming back up and I can't say the name of the town.
That was in Kentucky, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a fascinating story. I mean, it gets put in UFO literature, but it doesn't really fit with any other UFO literature.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, that definitely had an impact in the area.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, there's I think there's kind of an endless amount of stories you could do here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I do find it, I'm glad you told me that stuff about Whitehall. That makes it even more interesting to me that there was a UFO flap going on at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wish we could have focused more on it during the, you know, during the movie, but it just didn't happen.
Go on.
It's one of those things where like the movie's pretty much solely about, you know, those kind of creature sightings, and it wasn't going to work.
And I should clarify, I'm not suggesting that Bigfoot is an alien.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I'm suggesting that maybe they're both part of a common phenomena that's neither extraterrestrial nor physical flesh and blood monster.
Sure. And I always point out that there were, you know, UFO sightings in Minerva around the same time that the Minerva case was going on.
You find that a lot, and one gets ignored when the other one's going on. Because you have UFO people who don't care about the cryptid sightings, and you have the cryptid people who don't care about the UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%.
So it's, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I'm so on the fence about the Bigfoot thing because I know people are seeing something.
Mm-hmm.
And you got their hoaxes, sure, especially nowadays because, you know, people can get attention on the internet. But these stories are so old.
Yep.
And, they, you know, when you have Native American legends about them and it's the same thing people are seeing today, there's got to be something there.
Yeah. No, I agree. I always say I don't think there's an easy explanation. We can try to explain it away, but I just don't think there's an easy explanation for any of it.
Hmm. All right. So the Kickstarter starts in a few minutes. 2 minutes?
Yes. I actually just launched it, so it's live right now.
All
right.
And people can find it by going to Kickstarter and...
It's difficult. That's something I just noticed. It's like the most complicated URL. It's
can they just search for it?
They can, but it's kickstarter.com/project/MinervaMonster/BoggyCreekMonster.
Of course it is.
Yeah, naturally.
All right. And well, I wish you the best of luck with it. The first two I would recommend to people, definitely. Even though I didn't see the final version, I enjoyed the Beast of Whitehall quite a bit.
We'll get it to you. We'll get you a copy.
They both went by very quickly.
That's a good thing.
Yes, yes.
Because they're documentaries.
Yeah, and you know, the Minerva Monster I watched last night, and I'm watching it, and I'm like, wait, it's almost over? This was an hour long, you know?
Right. That's awesome. I'm so glad, though, that I haven't had anyone tell me that, so I'm glad to know it didn't bore you to tears either.
No, not at all. You present it in a very interesting way, and I like the fact that it's very dry. It's just, here's these people's stories. You got them telling them. You investigate different parts of it, but you're not putting a spin on it,
mm-hmm.
and you're not trying to force anything down anyone's throat.
Yep. That's our direction. That's what we try to do.
And you're not running around in the woods with, you know, night vision goggles and tripping over yourselves.
Definitely. That's all. I mean, I'm sure that would be fun to watch. And honestly, I think in behind the scenes stuff on Boggy Creek, that will be like, I'm not saying you're going to see us out doing wood knocks, but you probably will see us kind of actively out wandering around a little
sure,
bit.
Sure. I mean, because who knows what you might get.
Mm-hmm. Shot, probably.
All right. Thank you so much, Seth.
All right.
And,
thanks a lot.
Good luck with your Kickstarter. And I look forward to the Boggy Creek movie, when you do get it done.
Yeah, it'll be soon, I promise. We work quick.
All right, awesome. And again, next week, Mike Cleland and Aaron Gullius in part 750 of UFO history. I don't really know what part we're on anymore, maybe six. And yeah. And I'll have that Steph Young interview up this week or so for everybody. But if you're a patron, you'll get it in the next day or so. And right now, we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. This is Nightmares.
Shut the closet door. It's under the floor. The monster's there. The day I was born, you promised me hellfire. You were so sure I grew up waiting for demons to find me. I grew up hungry for ghosts to define me. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Suffering, offering doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slink me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn. I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform. Cause I'm a monster. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slink me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Rachel Clot, a cause des ailes. Home from Sector to Primavera. Give me the night. Death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Amnesia, give me an Armageddon. Give me the daring to forfeit ordinary dreams for the cost of pleasing humans far too steep. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. Door, it's under the floor, the monster's there, yeah.